Hello, and welcome to PubCasts, an ongoing project to experiment with science communication and making research more accessible and digestible to both scientific and general audiences. PubCasts are audiobook-style recordings of peer-reviewed scientific research read to you by the authors. I'm your host today, Dr. Hannah Harrison. This series is hosted by the Conservation of Change Lab and the Coastal Roots Project. Coastal Roots is a project led by Dr. Philip Loring and myself and aims at connecting research and storytelling about successful and novel adaptations to change in coastal communities in Canada and beyond. You can learn more about Coastal Roots by visiting www.coastalroots.org. That's www.coastalroots.org. And hey, check back in with the podcast to listen to new episodes and paper recordings monthly. PubCasts are inspired by a passion for podcasts, demystifying science, and the power of the human voice. Our goal is to give you, the listener, a new way to connect with research, and just as importantly, the researcher. These recordings will focus on trying to communicate a published research article in an engaging and convenient way, and I'll sometimes stop to explain a concept, give a short anecdote about the research experience, or emphasize a main point. Our hope is that this format will give researchers and academics a new way to engage with the literature, and for the non-academics out there, a way to hear about new science in a more interesting and digestible way. To keep things straightforward, you won't hear the in-text citations, long acronyms, or other details that make wading through a paper more challenging. But, like all peer-reviewed research, this work stands on the shoulders of researchers who came before. So, I strongly encourage you to visit the paper online and see the full reference list, as well as to enjoy the tables and figures that help explain some of the more interesting findings. And of course, we would love to hear your feedback. If you'd like, please tweet your comments, questions, or suggestions to us. You can find our Twitter information in the online details of this episode. Today's paper is entitled Nature's Little Helpers, a Benefits Approach to Voluntary Cultivation of Hatchery Fish to Support Wild Atlantic Salmon Populations in Norway, Wales, and Germany. This paper was written by myself, Hannah L. Harrison, Sophia Kochalski, Robert Arlinghaus, and Eystein Aas. This paper was published in Fisheries Research in August of 2018. You can read the full text and see the affiliations and other details of the authors at the journal's website. Part 1. Introduction. Stocking has been a much used and abused management tool in fisheries management and fisheries conservation worldwide. Now, stocking can have many objectives, which range from improving fishing opportunities to more conservation-oriented activities designed to protect and enhance small or declining populations. Now, though stocking of salmonids has historically been a really widespread and popular management initiative, particularly amongst stakeholder groups who want to improve wild stocks, improvements in scientific understandings of the potentially negative impacts of cultivation on wild salmonid populations has recently challenged the scientific and managerial opinions as related to stocking. Stocking can produce significant benefits to fisheries and help restore and conserve fish populations. Now, although a range of contextual factors affect the outlook of stocking programs, in many situations, alternative tools to stocking might prove superior in protecting and enhancing a threatened fish stock. However, stocking where hatchery fish are released into naturally recruiting populations can produce significant conservation concerns. Stocking has been documented to spread disease, affect local genetic integrity through population mixing, reduce population of growth of wild stocks, and contribute to the challenges faced by wild stock components in anthropogenically altered rivers. Now, over the past 30 to 40 years, science has become increasingly critical towards stocking in light of what's viewed as these unavoidable trade-offs between yield increase, cost, and the potential negative impacts on wild fish. As a result, in places where wild salmon populations still exist, stocking programs are increasingly becoming restricted, such as in Norway, or ended, such as in Wales, in a managerial preference to strengthen wild stocks through habitat restoration initiatives. Meanwhile, in places where salmon have already gone extinct, such as in Germany, or where populations are greatly declining, such as in France, there are little alternatives to stocking when trying to reestablish self-sustaining stocks in the wild. The same is true for rivers, where the local salmon population has been significantly affected by parasitic infection or environmental destruction. Now let's talk a little bit about governance. Stocking governance systems differ across the world. In some countries, like the USA or Canada, stocking is typically conducted by state-run or state-sanctioned hatcheries or by indigenous groups. Conversely, in much of Europe, fishing rights are private and tied to land ownership, and here, stocking decision-making is often conducted by local-level clubs and associations or by landowners, which from here on out we're going to refer to as cultivators. In the European context, it has been commonly observed that private actors organize voluntary hatcheries designed to support, protect, and restore wild stocks, particularly of iconic and high-demand species like Atlantic salmon or brown trout. And these initiatives still remain popular today amongst cultivator groups. This study focuses on what we term as voluntary hatcheries, or hatcheries operated by local angling or river owner groups for the purpose of conserving local wild Atlantic salmon stocks. Hatcheries and associated stocking programs raise three primary concerns. First, the physiology, behavior, and overall fitness of hatchery-reared fish and how they differ from their wild cohorts. Second, the effect of stocked fish on wild stock genetics through inbreeding and things like disease and parasite transmission. And three, a preference amongst many stakeholders, such as anglers, river owners, and sometimes local managers, for hatcheries over other options. Now, salmon cultivation opponents argue that hatcheries provide a false, easy fix to more insidious problems that affect salmon stocks, effectively taking away funding and interest from long-term conservation work, particularly around habitat restoration or rehabilitation. From an economic standpoint, hatchery and stocking critics also argue that stocked salmon have generally low return rates in comparison to wild fish, but they also then require a high annual investment. Stocking advocates, meanwhile, say that stocking programs may accelerate a population's recovery when used in tandem with habitat improvement work. And of course, in cases where a population verges on extinction, there's really no alternative to stocking due to a lack of wild stock that could produce sustainable recruits. Many organizations and stakeholders are involved in the stocking controversy at multiple scales of organization. International policies are often bluntly critical of salmonid stocking. For example, the Intergovernmental North Atlantic Salmon Conservation Organization's Williamsburg Resolution says, "It's designed to minimize impacts of aquaculture introductions, transfers, and transgenetics on the wild stocks." This is just one example of conservation guidelines that currently direct national-level fisheries managers and policymakers to develop more restrictive guidelines for country-specific stocking programs. Now, meanwhile, at the local level, hatchery supporters are trying to engage in this debate by citing hatchery-supportive literature and arguments, questioning the credibility of work that showcases these negative impacts of stocking, and often referencing the specific circumstances of local hatchery and stocking projects. Yet, managers are often compelled to rely upon best available science in designing cultivation policies, and that science is typically ecology or biology-oriented, omitting the human dimensions. This is really unfortunate, as human dimensions are usually of prime importance in fisheries management success, and attention focusing on the non-human dimensions of fisheries management runs the risk of ignoring important causes and drivers of conflict, and this is particularly true in cases of voluntary hatcheries and stocking in general. While the debate over hatcheries focuses primarily on the effectiveness and risks of stocking, alternative roles and benefits of stocking in hatcheries, such as the psychological and educational benefits of being involved in conservation, remain largely unexamined. In this context, voluntary cultivation of salmonids shares many similarities with outdoor recreation. For example, cultivating is an activity that's self-chosen and voluntary, and a large body of literature in outdoor recreation in general, and recreational fishing in particular, has underscored that participants engaging in such activities reap multiple types of benefits. These benefits then enable people to increase their overall well-being. The psychological, physiological, social, and economic benefits that accrue on the level of the individual also interact across scales, leading to effects on society at a larger scale. So, for example, engaging in cultivation can foster the subjective or cognitive and relational well-being of an individual while also achieving instrumental conservation benefits that benefit communities or entire human ecological systems. If participants in voluntary cultivation of salmon derive multiple benefits from this activity, the resulting individual and societal benefits potentially exceed the costs of fish cultivation and its assumed physical contribution to salmon conservation. In other words, we can look at the benefits that individuals are receiving, how they scale up to the societal level, and then have a new different kind of cost analysis against the costs of fish cultivation and the different kinds of benefits it produces outside of the actual production of fish. In this paper, we posit that voluntary hatcheries produce multiple benefits at both individual and group levels that exceed this previous narrow focus on the biological contribution of hatcheries to wild salmon populations. we draw on the multiple benefits framework from outdoor recreation research, and the objective of the study is to identify and assess the full range of benefits produced by voluntary hatcheries. Part 2, methods. So we used an ethnographic approach in this study, and while I won't go into a lot of detail in it here, the key thing to know is that we used in-depth semi-structured interviews with approximately 15 to 25 individuals per country from across a variety of stakeholder groups. If you'd like to read more about the methods, and we do go into quite a lot of detail in the paper, including study areas and the nature of the interviewing and the data analysis, I encourage you to look up the paper online. The key thing to know here is that all of the results that you're about to hear are based on a qualitative analysis of those interviews. Part 3, results. In this study, we identified a range of psychological, social, and conservation benefits mentioned by interviewees as derived from their participation in hatchery and salmon stocking activities. Now, we go into quite a lot of depth in the results, and we have quite a lot of tables that give a great deal of detail on the different kinds of benefits that we found. I won't go into as much detail here in the podcast, but I do encourage you to take a look at this section of the paper if you'd like to see all of the details of those benefits. So let's begin with psychological benefits. The first benefits we recognized are achievement, contribution, and satisfaction, which is also the subheading of this section. Cultivators reported strong feelings of personal satisfaction resulting from their cultivation activities. Cultivators found great value in caring for and contributing to the well-being of salmon, especially when it came to releasing those salmon into the wild. And this satisfaction derives from two subsidiary feelings that we felt were very closely linked: achievement and contribution. In terms of achievement, cultivators really enjoyed overcoming the challenges of raising a really sensitive and at-risk species like salmon. And in the case of Germany, this feeling of completing the impossible task of bringing back an extinct species. Now, closely linked to this was cultivators' perceived ability to learn a new skill, adapt their cultivation practices to the challenges of the local environment, and successfully raise other vulnerable juveniles and other types of species. Doing that hatchery work and participating in the salmon stocking was really deeply satisfying to cultivators and created a lot of positive feelings of self-esteem and achievement. In terms of contribution, cultivators felt that they had a responsibility as anglers to contribute to the well-being of salmon, and many cultivators enjoyed being part of something bigger than themselves. As one Norwegian cultivator described it, quote, "When everything is natural, you thank God that it works. But as an older angler told me, why don't we just help God a little bit? He's a busy man, and he can't fix everything. We have to give him a hand sometimes," end quote. I want to say, just stepping out of the text here for a moment, that when we were doing the interview and we heard that quote, which was being translated into English from Norwegian at the time, that really was kind of a heart-melting moment, because it connected to me exactly how the cultivators in this were feeling and how that they felt that they were part of really something much bigger than themselves. And it tied to perhaps religious aspects of their lives, as well as the spirituality and significance that they associated with the run of salmon coming back every year. For many cultivators, hatchery work supports a nature ethic based around care for and interaction with nature, and a philosophy of the responsibility to engage in work that will benefit the natural world. Now, many cultivators considered the hatchery to be a symbol of that nature ethic, and the cultivation work itself was an act of ethical fulfillment. Nearly all the cultivators we spoke with indicated strongly that their motivation to do cultivation work was primarily to give back to nature, in a belief that this was conservation work and that it was a good thing to do, both for people and for salmon. And that was really exemplified by the chairman of one German angling club, who said, quote, "We wanted to do more than just a normal angling club. To put it this way, we wanted to give something back to nature. As a user of nature, one takes from nature, destroys nature, and that was a bit of the original idea, to give something back to nature," end quote. Section 3.1.2, Hobby and Leisure Time. In all cases, hatchery work was perceived as meaningful and highly enjoyable, and many cultivators categorized their hatchery work as an important hobby or leisure activity. Dependent on the time of the year, some of the cultivators spent a significant amount of time, sometimes more than an hour a day, in the hatchery doing cultivation-related work. And interestingly, many cultivators also spent unstructured free time in the hatchery when no work was required. This behavior seemed to be linked to their fascination, their awe, and their desire to interact frequently with the juvenile salmon. Another reason for frequent hatchery visits was the social factor, as many groups host regular social meetings in the hatchery. As explained by one Norwegian cultivator, quote, "I think that that's the important thing and why people are willing to do it. It's social. We meet often every Friday in the hatchery and have a chat and spend time. We have a little house down by the river there. It's very nice. We sit there and watch the fish in the summer, so of course it's social. That's a really important thing when you're going to use so much of your free time." End quote. Hatcheries also fulfilled an annual cycle of salmon activity for cultivators. For approximately half the year, cultivators filled their free time with angling, and when the angling season ended, cultivators switched to filling their free time once spent angling then with hatchery work. For many, this transition from angling to cultivation also achieved a sort of transition from extraction of the salmon resource to contributing to that resource. And the satisfaction achieved by this pairing of activities related strongly to the nature ethics that I discussed before. Section 3.1.3, Personal Identity. The personal identity of cultivators was strongly linked to and supported by their involvement in hatchery work. Cultivators experienced strong feelings of independence and self-determination while working in the hatchery. And some cultivators even said that they would be lost without the hatchery as part of their weekly routine. Being a volunteer, a salmon person, capable craftsman in charge of hatchery operations, or even a respected member of the club's board formed an important part of how cultivators developed positive self-perception. In some cases, cultivators related not only their personal identities to their relationships with salmon cultivation, but also their national identities. As one fisherman in Norway described, quote, "Everyone has a relation to salmon, because salmon? That's Norway. Atlantic salmon, that's Norway. Every Norwegian has a relationship to salmon, I think. Yes, I remember when I was a small boy, once in a while, a small piece of salmon to eat, it was heaven," end quote. So now let's transition to section 3.2, where we talk about social benefits. We'll begin with the facilitation of social relationships. We found that hatcheries were important social outlets, particularly for middle to late-aged male anglers. Hatcheries provided cultivators with ways to enjoy time with peers who had similar interests through activities that they found mutually meaningful and fulfilling. The social aspect was also important to younger cultivators who enjoyed spending time with and learning from the older members of the hatchery community. Time spent with multiple generations of anglers was an important prerequisite for the transfer of knowledge, and intergenerational activities also supported the recruitment of new individuals into fishing and cultivation activities. Cultivators argued that hatcheries provided opportunities for young people to take part in traditional, or in this case, heritage activities related to an iconic species. Section 3.2.2, Networking. Hatcheries act as facilitators of social network development by bringing together individuals who might otherwise not interact through activities such as broodstock collection, stocking, and fin clipping, all of which demand significant labor and participation. Leaders of some angling groups reported that work done in hatcheries helped spread awareness and support for other activities, such as teaching fishing skills to children and adults, visits to or by schools to hatcheries to teach conservation and ecosystem sciences, or activities like litter cleanups and riverbank maintenance, all activities that additionally provide direct conservation benefits in addition to social value. Cultivators also said that they enjoyed meeting people from outside their regular social networks and making social connections related to angling and other recreational activities. As one German cultivator described, quote, "What is typical for our club is that many people got to know each other very well. The club consists of very different groups of people, so let's say from a lawyer to a craftsman, and somehow everyone has this common topic that connects them, and there are no barriers, no barriers at all," end quote. Opportunities to work on cultivation also built trust and working relationships between cultivation groups, like anglers and river owners, and fisheries scientists and management officials. Cultivators in all cases expressed concern about a lack of support for hatcheries from fisheries managers and policymakers. But in cases where managers, policymakers, or scientists included hatcheries in conservation schemes, cultivators responded with increased trust and interest in cooperation. As a Welsh biologist described, quote, "I've seen a lot of my fisheries management colleagues hated by anglers, and who hate the anglers with a similar passion, and yet we've always had a fantastic relationship with them. I mean, okay, partly that's because they see hatcheries as a great thing because they're putting fish in the wild, but it's also partially because we recognize the value of giving these guys some ownership of some part of the river, of something that they have to take care of themselves, have pride in, learn from, and have a passion for other things about the environment. Conservation, that's really important." End quote. And that leads us really nicely into section 3.3, where we talk about conservation benefits. Let's start out with talking about facilitation of conservation work. Voluntary hatcheries provided opportunities for cultivators to participate in conservation activities due to the low barrier to entry that hatcheries provide compared with that of habitat improvement projects, which can often be expensive and require overcoming substantial legal requirements. Participation in hatchery and stocking activities also contributed to cultivators' interest, support, and engagement in other types of conservation work that were otherwise unrelated to stocking. Importantly, cultivators developed the skills they needed to do these other types of conservation work in the hatchery. Across all three cases that we include in this study, these activities included things like the creation and improvement of spawning habitats and the removal of barriers for migration. Let me give you one example of what I mean here. So, because the cultivators in Norway, for instance, were spending a lot of time doing assessments of the different of the fish that they were producing from the hatchery. So every autumn they would go and do a full river walk where they try and evaluate what's here in the river, what sort of fish are there, and are they coming from our hatchery? Is there any way for us to evaluate that? Well, during this time in the autumn, there are often storms in the fjords that cause the escape of farmed salmon from nearby farms into this area. And in this case, because the cultivators are already on the river doing that stock assessment because of their interest and participation with the salmon through the hatchery, they're able to identify, catch, remove, and report some of the escaped farmed salmon that sometimes make it up the river there. Hatchery activities also led developers to develop relationships with scientific, conservation, and in some rare cases, aquaculture interests to generate financial, intellectual, and material support for their hatchery work. In all cases, we found that cultivators were trying to incorporate best management practices into their hatchery operations and expressed interest in participating in scientific studies focused on their local fish populations. Cultivators also often exhibited long-term efforts to learn cultivation techniques recommended by the scientific literature and to develop working relationships with researchers. And of course, that was an interest that we as a research team were most grateful for. Now let's look at section 3.3.2, biodiversity and mitigating future disaster. Cultivators believe voluntary hatcheries provide support to biodiversity initiatives and scientific research on wild Atlantic salmon. In both Norway and Germany, for instance, voluntary hatcheries raise brown or sea trout alongside salmon, while in Wales, their last remaining hatchery, which is now only used for research purposes, is used to grow indigenous, critically endangered species, such as the freshwater pearl mussel. Cultivators in this study pointed out that the skill and knowledge used to grow salmon in voluntary hatcheries could also be used to support restoration or conservation work for other species, an added conservation benefit, especially in rural areas where no other such facilities exist. Cultivators and some fisheries managers view hatcheries as repositories of cultivation skill and knowledge, held collectively within the cultivators themselves and supported, developed, and transferred through their social interactions. As one fisheries manager on the River Wye said, quote, "The other point is retaining capacity and competence. The husbandry of salmonids would be an important skill competence, so we're maintaining that hatchery for rearing of salmon for investigative purposes, and we believe that retaining that capacity and competence is important." This knowledge and skill base, along with the physical capacity of the hatchery itself, act as an insurance policy, so to speak, that could mitigate against future ecological and anthropogenic disaster within the targeted salmon stock or river ecosystem. Let's move on to section 4, the discussion. This study revealed a rich bundle of benefits produced by voluntary hatcheries that exceed their biological contributions to wild salmon conservation and fisheries. In our three cases, voluntary hatcheries provided or facilitated many psychological, social, and conservation benefits, all of which had notable parallels to non-catch benefits produced by recreational angling opportunities. And we did find all three of these benefit domains identified across all three cases, though, of course, some were stronger in some cases than in others. Across all three cases, it did stand out that the most significant benefit produced by these voluntary hatcheries was this means of participating in salmon conservation. The use of hatcheries is an acting environmental stewardship, and this runs counter to common perceptions that angler-driven stocking efforts are motivated primarily to improve catch opportunities through this technological fix, which is sometimes called techno-arrogance in the conservation literature. Rather, we found that enhancing opportunities for angling was either not relevant or took a seemingly secondary role in motivating hatchery work. Another key benefit facilitated by voluntary hatcheries was the ability for cultivators to engage in and support non-hatchery-related management and conservation by generating networks, resources, and other types of human capital that were necessary to engage in small or sometimes large-scale conservation activities. And these would include things like stock monitoring, removal of escaped farm salmon, and habitat improvement. Now, importantly, these examples of participation in conservation are distinct from work that's being done by state hatchery programs, which were common in Norway and formerly in Wales, and, of course, to the salmon and stocking that we find in North America. And that's important because these state programs typically do not offer opportunities for the lay public to take part in the hatchery and, by extension, their conservation work. Section 4.1, examining hatchery-related benefits through frameworks for understanding benefits of outdoor recreation. Now, in this section, I'm not going to go into it in great depth because we spend a lot of time comparing the different kinds of benefits that we found produced by these voluntary hatcheries to the different types of benefits and categories of benefit that we find in the outdoor recreation frameworks and literatures. That said, I do want to highlight that many of the benefits that we found produced within the conservation, social, or psychological realms of benefits were produced through interdependencies, and those interdependencies raised some interesting questions about the nature and, importantly, the substitutability of voluntary hatchery work. I'll step out of the text just for a second to say that one of the critiques that we often heard about all of these different benefits being produced is, well, surely those could be substituted. Instead of working in hatcheries, we could close hatcheries and people could go recreational angling, for instance, or they could do some other activity that would substitute and create some of those same benefits. And that raises the important question, is voluntary cultivation just another broad form of outdoor recreation focused on fish and fishing, or does this work belong in a category of activity that's more akin to traditional non-government organization conservation work, such as habitat improvement, monitoring, or even activism? In answering that question, our study shows that we know that cultivators are seeking hatchery activities in addition to their regular recreation activities, such as angling, and that suggests that cultivation work fulfills different needs or provides different and supplementary benefits from those already obtained elsewhere. From this, we conclude that voluntary hatchery work, while providing many of the same benefits as typical recreation activities, is not typically sought after as a recreational pursuit, and therefore should not be categorized as a recreational activity per se. Rather, engagement in voluntary hatcheries can be constructed as providing opportunity to achieve a higher good, to give something back to nature, and to help salmon recover or maintain their populations in the face of environmental or, in some cases, political adversity, perhaps best termed as environmental stewardship. Section 4.2, understanding the drivers that keep hatcheries open. In addition to the reasons that I've already talked about, preference for hatcheries over other types of conservation activities may be a result of historical path dependencies, political visibility of stocking, or strong social norms by the angler constituency. For example, all of the cases in this study had a long-lasting tradition of hatcheries where stocking had been a key management and conservation tool for a long time, and that likely transferred hatchery practices into becoming a habit. Once that transformation occurred, cessation or substitution of that activity becomes exceedingly difficult due to loss aversion in light of the multiple benefits created by hatcheries that we establish in this study. The cultivators in our cases had few, if any, alternative means of pursuing their conservation drive due to substantial legal and economic structural constraints in pursuing habitat work. This is another reason why voluntary hatcheries have become the primary outlet for conservation work for local stakeholders and anglers. What's considered a stubborn allegiance by anglers to hatcheries for conservation reflects these constraints, as well as the other benefits that they derive from participating in hatchery-based conservation. Importantly, I think it's useful to talk about how habitat improvement is different from stocking, since these really tend to be the two dichotomies, if you will, that come up in the stocking debate. Habitat improvement demands intensive networking with other social ecological systems and decision makers, and often suffers from low implementation rates and high costs. By moving from hatcheries to habitat work, cultivators would lose some sovereignty through collaborating with agencies, agricultural sectors, hydropower, etc., and thus the transactions cost of habitat management are high. And thus it is unlikely that habitat management activities can easily substitute the benefits derived from voluntary hatcheries when looking from a sociocultural perspective. Finally, in places where voluntary hatchery status is under debate, understanding how these multiple benefits are valued will help to explain conflict-oriented behaviors from both cultivators and managers. From this study, it is clear that this focus on efficacy and cost effectiveness by some scientists and managers is really viewed in a different way than how local cultivators see these issues. Put more succinctly, it is clear that groups in these cases are valuing and prioritizing the benefits produced by voluntary hatcheries differently. This point is essential, as contemporary debates about hatcheries and stocking have focused on the efficacy of hatcheries to help conserve wild stocks as compared to economic and opportunity costs, and most scientific discussions relate to the actual contribution, or sometimes damage, that hatcheries can do to wild salmon and stocks in their environment. I cannot emphasize enough, but this is not the framing that local cultivators have about their hatcheries. Consequently, many scientists and managers effectively ignore these many other psychological, social, and conservation benefits that are produced by voluntary hatcheries and that matter very much to the stakeholders in question. Assumptions that the drivers for continued local hatchery work on salmon are primarily related to increased opportunities to catch fish are absolutely refuted by this study, and that's particularly true in the Welsh and the Norwegian cases. The same is true for assumptions that the lack of engagement in alternatives to stocking is the result of the inability of cultivators to understand and adapt to new scientific knowledge. Further efforts to manage voluntary hatcheries solely from this framing will likely exacerbate existing conflicts between stakeholder groups. If public managers of rivers and fisheries need or want to restrict or terminate hatchery programs, our study suggests that they must be aware of the multiple meanings that cultivators attach to hatcheries and the specific contextual setting in which hatcheries are operated. Managers and other decision makers would be well advised to accept the underlying psychological forces that are behind voluntary hatcheries and be cautious in their communications and decision making if they are to maintain a constructive dialogue. Section 4.3, Holistic Strategies for Managing Voluntary Hatcheries. A key message of this article is the importance of hatcheries to hatchery practitioners and how they and society gain many important benefits from hatcheries apart from the production of salmon. To that end, management of voluntary hatcheries should be cognizant of and ideally facilitate these different types of benefits. Now, while legitimate concerns about hatcheries should absolutely not be ignored, managers could shift the focus and purpose of voluntary hatcheries toward a more holistic approach. They could do this by adding non-biological benefits to stocking and hatchery objectives. Of course, the shift would not just be easy. It would require all stakeholders to reach a shared understanding of the goals and objectives that underlie hatchery programs, consider trade-offs to achieve multiple outcomes, and recognize the merit of all stakeholders' argues and values. This change of perspective would achieve a broader scope of purpose for hatcheries and avoid alienating stakeholder groups that pursue conservation activities, but who also derive social and psychological benefits from hatchery work. Until now, cultivators have been incentivized to argue their case in support of hatcheries from a stock-based perspective, and that means engaging in a power dynamic that situates research-based knowledge as superior to other knowledge types. However, research on the efficacy of voluntary hatcheries is often insufficient, and that allows the hatchery debate to continue without sufficient information. Rather than relying upon reactive commentary on top-down proposed policy changes, we recommend a transdisciplinary management approach, which will achieve four important outcomes. Outcome one, explicit consideration of non-conservation benefits, like those that we've outlined in this paper. Outcome two, jointly produced knowledge that brings better information into hatchery management and effectively corrects misconceptions held by anglers, cultivators, or managers about the achievements of stocking programs. Outcome three, increase buy-in of non-scientists into research outcomes. And outcome four, help in resolution conflict. And I just want to take a little aside here and say that though we recommend a transdisciplinary management approach that achieves those different outcomes, we don't go into a lot of detail here in the paper about what steps one might take to do that. However, we do provide some really good references of other studies where people have experimented with and achieved some of those management approaches. So I want to refer you to the text in this section right before the conclusion if you're interested in looking at those references. All right, so let's finish up. Section 5, the conclusion. Our study shows that voluntary hatcheries provide diverse and bundled psychological, social, and conservation benefits to both cultivators and salmon stocks. These benefits have strong parallels to benefits derived from recreational angling and outdoor recreation in general, but are likely not replaceable by angling or other already present recreational activities in these case studies. Decision makers could take advantage of these many benefits by creating better defined goals and objectives for hatchery and or stocking projects in harmony and close collaboration with hatchery operators, by pursuing joint studies and co-production of knowledge about stocking impacts and outcomes, and by better fostering civil engagement towards salmon conservation with anglers and other stakeholders. In this study, we found that hatchery groups have the same basic goals as most river and fishery managers: to generate means to help salmon maintain or recover their populations. Looking forward, it will be beneficial to build on this common interest and jointly work toward addressing the overarching reasons for why wild salmon stocks often decline. By contrast, taking an exclusive biological perspective and being overly critical of hatchery efforts promises to create enduring tension with those for whom hatcheries provide the means to generate meaningful civil engagement for salmon conservation. Instead, we recommend that greater opportunity should be made of cultivators' willingness to participate in a wider set of conservation measures that go beyond stocking and provide political and social resources to address the reasons for salmon decline. Thanks for listening to this episode of PubCasts. To hear more PubCasts or to see the broad library brought to you by Coastal Roots Radio, visit the project website at www.coastalroots.org. That's www.coastalroots.org.